May it please the court, my name is Michael F. DeManna. My registration number is 2300. With me at council table is my co-counsel, Ms. Pawar, Neethi Pawar. She's an attorney at law, and Ms. Pawar authored the briefs that were submitted in this case. I was the trial counsel, began representing Mr. Johnson at the time that the dissolution of marriage was filed back in May of 2007. The parties separated in this matter in October of 2006, and there was a substantial period of time between their separation and the actual filing of the case. The importance of that is that as time was going on, the financial circumstances of this marriage was substantially deteriorating. The parties with members of their family had been in the real estate business in the state of California, developing residential real estate lots. The real estate market was beginning to crash at the time of the filing of the case, and of course, I think as the court is well aware, that market substantially deteriorated and crashed during the course of the case. What became important as the case progressed was the security interest of a bank in California, which not only held a secured lien against the real estate which was owned, but also had the personal guarantees of the husband in this case, as well as his brother, and also had the guarantees of the other assets that were owned by the parties. So at the time that the case was actually tried, the financial circumstances of the parties was at substantial risk. The case was tried over a period of 5 days over two issues. First issue was the wife's claim that the husband, prior to the filing of the dissolution, back a number of years prior to the filing of the dissolution, had used the marital estate and dissipated it for non-marital purposes. Her position on that issue was found not to be sustained by the trial court. She has not appealed that issue, so it becomes the law of the case. Her second claim was that the security interests, which were held by related parties in the case, the husband's father, the trust of his brother, the trust of his sister, and one of the members of his company, were in fact not valid debt, and the security that was claimed for that debt was also not valid. The trial court likewise found against the wife on that position, and the wife has not appealed to this court regarding either of those two findings. So, what the case really then came down to
was... Those are the two issues that are tried. Why are we here?
Well, here's why we're here.
Okay.
We're here because the trial court absolutely misapplied the law, basic law in the domestic relations area, in terms of creating the property division in this case. And it's for that reason that we have appealed and are asking the court to look at this matter on a de novo review.
It's not like property division was not an issue in front of the court.
Property division was a very big issue before the court. But it was an issue in terms of how do we accomplish or how are we given an opportunity to create an orderly dissolution of the marital estate so as to pay the debt as well as to protect the interests of both the parties to go forward. And it was at that point that the trial court made, in our view, some substantial error of law in terms of what was done. And the first issue is that we've raised, or one of the issues that we've raised, is the way the court divided the marital estate. And the error of law that the court made in dividing that marital estate was that the court made no finding as to the value of the marital assets at the date of the decree. As I'm sure this court noted in looking at the permanent order issued by the judge in the case, the significant asset of the parties, that being Johnson Communities Incorporated, has no value set forth next to it. In fact, the only comments that are made by the trial court and also by the wife's counsel is that there was testimony regarding a potential estimate of value some number of years in the future. Well, of course, the basic law is that the trial court must value property at the date of the decree, and opinion or estimate of value in the future is not a proper consideration for valuation.
So, Mr. DeManna, can you please tell me where in the record there was evidence presented by husband as to what the value of JCI was?
Ma'am, Judge, all of the values were stipulated to. So when the case began...
Let me ask you a question about that. I think the position in your brief is the values of the Riverside properties and the Delmar properties were stipulated to based on, I think it was a March 09 appraisal.
Yes, sir.
March 08. Are you saying that the value of those properties is the value of Johnson Communities, Inc., and there's nothing else in it by way of assets?
I'm sorry?
Are you saying that the property, the fact that there was a property stipulation, it seems to me your brief is saying that established the value of Johnson Communities, Inc., I guess it's called, JCI.
Mm-hmm.
Were there no other assets in Johnson Communities, Inc. besides the property?
There were other assets. There was a certificate deposit being held at California Bank and Trust, which also had stipulated value.
Right.
So as the court will note, when you reviewed the transcript, there were no experts called to value not only the real estate of Johnson Communities. There were no witnesses called to value any of the assets of the parties because they were all stipulated to. Every value in the case was a stipulated value. And therefore, it is troubling when we reviewed the order in terms of what the trial court did, that the trial court made no findings as to what the value of the assets were. And here's why that's important. Because if you fail to make a finding as to the value of the major asset in this case, Johnson Communities Incorporated, then you can't tell how disparate the division is in terms of who was awarded what assets.
I understand your position, but what I'm trying to find out is where would I look in the record for evidence that was presented to Judge Dubofsky about what the value of JCI was, and what are there pieces that he would have had to add up, and if so, where were those pieces? What were they?
The court will look at the trial management certificate that was filed at the time of the trial of the case or the week before the trial. The court will see all the stipulations which the parties reached regarding the value of the various assets.
Okay, and that has a stipulated value for JCI?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
It sure does. So, again, the difficulty here was, what did the trial court actually do with regard to the stipulations of the parties relating to the value of that asset, particularly at the date of the decree?
What was the stipulated value of JCI, if you recall?
The stipulated value was $6.8 million in assets and $10 million of debt. So, for a husband's interest, it was a negative $1.6 million. And we have put into our brief a schedule, if the court wishes to look at it, in terms of how, assuming the trial court used the stipulated values, as to how the property divisions are inequitable in terms of what was received by both. So, failure to value on the date of the decree, use by the trial court, we believe, of speculative value. The judge mentioned several times that the husband believed that if given an opportunity, he could create value in JCI of $10 million. And finally, the failure, and most importantly, one of the most important things, is the failure to offset that value with the debt. And again, the trial court makes a comment in its order that the husband is awarded JCI and its debts. Again, no specific finding as to the value of those debts. By value, I mean what the debts were at the date of the decree, and they were significant, well over $10 million. So that's the JCI issue and the property division issue.
How much of the $10 million in
debt were the debts to family members? The debt to the trust of two family members were $3.7 million. And again, one of the issues that the wife made, claimed at trial, and which was resolved against her was that, in fact, that really wasn't debt, that the monies were not actually owed to these related parties, and that there was no valid security for those obligations. The trial court found against her on both of those issues. This becomes compounded now when we look at the maintenance issue, because since we don't have a finding as to the value of the assets at the date of the decree, we're not sure whether or not the basic requirement of the statute, which says before you can get maintenance, you must demonstrate that you lack sufficient assets after the division of the marital estate to provide for your reasonable needs, and you must be unable to support yourself through appropriate employment. Assuming that the wife met the second part of that burden, the first question is, did she lack sufficient assets to provide for her reasonable needs? We don't know the answer to that question. The court further compounded it by making a finding that certain, that one of the major assets in the case, this condominium, commonly called Bachelor Gulch, up in Avon, was the separate property of the wife. What's so confounding about that is...
Wait, let me ask you a question. What is the difference? You said that you can't make a determination if the wife lacked assets. Well, if all of JCI was assigned to the husband, that didn't have any effect on whether she lacked assets or not, did it? You don't have to look at the assets she got.
Well, it didn't have an effect on what assets she got, correct? And she got some assets, yes.
Right. So for purposes of determining whether she lacked assets, whether JCI is worth $100 million or minus $6 million, the husband got that, so it doesn't really affect the wife's right to maintenance.
Well, it affects it because...
It may affect the husband's ability to pay it, but I don't, that's
exactly. It affects it because the debt against JCI is so significant, and that was also assigned to the husband. What happened here was that instead of the trial court accepting a basis which allowed us to proceed through an orderly resolution of the sale of property and the division of some of the income that was coming in, the trial court burdened the husband with all of the assets subject to all of the debt and gave to the wife assets which did not have any debt. For example, the New York apartment building was awarded to the wife. There was no debt against that asset. But as I say, this problem is compounded, and I want to reserve at least 3 minutes to respond to Mr. Walker's comments. This problem is substantially compounded when you have a trial court without any evidence at all finding an asset, the Bachelor Gulch interest, to be separate property of the wife based upon a claimed gift. And instead, I say there's no evidence of that at all because, as we've cited in our brief, every financial statement filed by the wife in the case made no claim of separate property. The trial management certificate filed a week before the trial. The wife claimed that the Bachelor Gulch property was all marital and it should all be awarded to her. And there was no evidence admitted during the course of the trial where the wife made any claim that she had a separate property interest in the Bachelor Gulch property.
The trial court judge sitting as a court of equity can disregard the party's positions and do equity, can't he?
Well, the court can only disregard the party's positions if it's supported by the evidence. In this case, we have a statute that says if a husband transfers to a wife an asset, it's presumptively transferred to the marriage unless the recipient can prove by clear and convincing evidence that that was not the intention and not the transfer. So while a trial judge has certain authority and equity to do some things, he can't disregard the law, and he certainly can't disregard the facts. Where this finding came from was a mystery to both counsel, certainly a mystery to me, and that was the trial counsel, Mr. Walker, was it? And I believe it was also a mystery to Mrs.
Well, there was testimony about a Christmas gift. Yeah. I've seen that testimony in the records.
There was testimony that at Christmas in 2003, a family partnership was created where interests owned by the parties during the marriage, each husband and wife had 50%, where interests owned by the parties during the marriage were gifted to their children's trust, and those interests then were changed between the parties. The wife received a 9% additional interest, and the husband received 1% as part of the ownership of a partnership which then owned the asset. But there was absolutely no claim that this would constitute the separate property of the wife. And for the trial court to make that finding is completely unsupported by not only the record, but by the facts of the case. And I'd like to reserve what limited time I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
A little. It's in a minute now.
Good afternoon. May I please the court? My name is Timothy B. Walker, registration number 5351. I represent the appellee, the wife in this case. Preliminarily, I would like to state two things. One, I was not the trial counsel in this case. I'm the appellate counsel. Number two, I'm looking at page 10 of the trial management certificate, the joint trial management certificate that Mr. DeManna referred to, under stipulations and undisputed facts. I see no stipulation as to the value of JCI. I see stipulations as to the value of certain real estate owned by JCI, but I don't see a value of JCI, and that is because there was no evidence as to value of JCI except what was presented at trial, which I'd like to get into. I'd like to focus, if I might.
Let me ask him the same question I asked Mr. DeManna. Yes. Did JCI have assets besides these real estate properties that were appraised and set forth in this?
In its goodwill, I don't think so, Your Honor.
So if the properties were all of JCI, doesn't that number stipulate to, in fact, represent the value of JCI?
Stipulation accepted by the court is a stipulation, I believe, yes.
No, that's not really answering my question. I mean, he's saying that the stipulation is the value of JCI. If JCI had other assets, of course, the stipulation is to the real estate doesn't stipulate to the value of JCI. And you're saying it had no other assets, so why doesn't it suffice?
Because there was some evidence as to whether there was waste by the husband of certain of the notes associated with JCI, as I understand it. The trial court rejected that argument by the wife that there was waste and accepted the argument of the husband's expert and the husband's CEO, Marcy Campbell, and the husband himself. And I think that's critical because what we have in that situation, Your Honors, is that not only was there a stipulation as to the value of assets held by JCI, but there was also testimony presented by the husband, by the husband's expert, and by JCI's CEO as to value. And in fact, the husband testified that he expected the value of JCI to be $10 million.
Now,
he felt that it was to have value if there was a sale of certain lots that were held by JCI, the Delmar lots, I believe. And that's important because the husband's opinion of the value of JCI is important evidence that the court can consider under, for example, first law I can give you is the Buyer case. In Remarriage of Buyer, 687 Pacific 2nd, 537, cited in our brief.
Well, there's no doubt that the husband's testimony can be looked at by the trial court, but we are concerned about the fact that there is no valuation number in the court's order. And so what I'm trying to dig into is what evidence was there from which the trial court could have set a value for JCI? Was it only the stipulated values of the real estate, or was there something else that the trial court could have looked at?
There was testimony by the CEO of JCI, Marcy Campbell, that indicated that in her opinion the value of JCI was at least 6.7 or 6.8 million.
Positive value.
Yes.
Where is that testimony?
It is cited in our brief, Your Honor, at page 13. And I believe it is in the findings of the amended permanent orders, page 712. May I continue? Thank you. There are actually three issues in this case, not just the question of the value of JCI, which I know is of interest to this court, but there was also the question of this gift. As to whether the Bachelor Gulch property was properly found by the court to be a gift. And I'll preface what I'm saying by indicating that the law is in Colorado that if the trial court's findings are supported by the record, they're going to be sustained. Now, Mr. DeManna's argument is that there is no record of any substance to sustain the trial court's finding by clear and convincing evidence that there was a gift.
Well, does he say that a gift, or does he say there was no evidence that necessary to overcome the presumption that it could be a property? Things you could have a gift and it still might not be separate property.
Absolutely, and even the pre-2002 amendment to 1410.113 subsection 7 says that any presumption of a gift to the marriage or to one spouse can be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. So does the 2002 amendment to 1410.113 subsection 7.
And in fact, it requires such evidence. It requires clear and convincing evidence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was the clear and convincing evidence in this record that the husband made a gift to the wife intending it to be separate property? And I ask that question given the stipulations that there was no separate property, I mean the financial statement that there was no separate property. I saw no evidence of the wife testifying that it was intended to be a gift of separate property. So could you please point me to the clear and convincing evidence that supported that conclusion?
I think I can, Your Honor. It's trial court exhibit number 49. It was the operating agreement of Johnson Family Management, LLC, which was admitted into evidence. That document was signed on December 24th, 2003 by both Mr. and Mrs. Johnson. And in that document, there was a recitation that the Bachelor Gulch property, the interest in the Bachelor Gulch property, was intended as a gift, G-I-F-T.
And that, how do we know that it was a gift intended to be separate property? And I understand there was a gift to the children in the same document, and certainly a gift to the children is a gift. But we're talking about an interspousal transfer here, and the statute doesn't say it has to be clear and convincing evidence as a gift of separate property.
Your Honor, I believe it was intended under the operating agreement to be a gift, as far as the 49% interest is concerned, to the wife. I can read that part of the operating agreement, Your Honor, and that says this amendment made pursuant to section 14.2 of the operating agreement, Johnson Family Management, to reflect a gift of a 9% non-voting member in interest from Courtney Johnson to Cynthia Johnson. Doesn't say the children, Your Honor.
That's a fair sense. Yes. Right.
So, following up on what Judge Richmond said, so that establishes that there was to be an interspousal gift from the husband to wife.
Correct.
That's to clear separate property issue. That's what we're all struggling with, not whether there was. We have this statute staring us in the face.
Well, under the Bartolo case, which was cited by Judge Dabosky in his amended permanent orders, he said, to the extent that the husband argues that the transfer was done for tax or other purposes, he argued the transfer was an estate planning device, it seems inappropriate to create a gift to avoid other legal consequences and then to declare that the transfer was not intended as a gift. Also, with respect to the 2002 amendment, the court, and so this is cited on page 9 of our brief. Found that I find, this is in his amended permanent orders, I find by clear and convincing evidence that the husband intended the property as a gift to his wife and children. And
understand that.
Yes.
What the clear and convincing evidence was. And the only thing you're pointing us to, as I understand it, is the language of Exhibit 49 and something about the husband's testimony that it was for estate tax purposes. What about, what regarding the husband's testimony about estate tax purposes indicates clear and convincing evidence that it was intended to be transferred to the wife as her separate property? Did he so testify, Mr. Johnson, and explain that estate planning purpose?
Mr. Johnson was offered the opportunity based on his motion for new trial. Judge Dabosky offered Mr. Johnson the opportunity to provide further evidence that the property transfer was not a gift, and he refused to do so. There's one issue that hasn't been discussed fully, I believe, and that's the somewhat intriguing issue of whether the trial court abused its discretion in imputing income, finding the husband to be voluntarily underemployed for purposes of calculating spousal maintenance. Well, we now all know that under 1410.115, the court can clearly impute income and find a parent voluntarily unemployed or underemployed for child support purposes. But the question is whether that same imputation can occur with respect to spousal maintenance. I think there's no direct authority for that proposition. I'll start with that. But I think there is some persuasive authority that may be indirect in Colorado, and I'd like to go through it. In awarding spousal maintenance, the trial court can consider, among other things, future earning capacity of a party. Future earning capacity can be found by looking at the employment history or the income producing history of that same party. That's in re the Marriage of Armstrong, in re the Marriage of Gray, all cited in our briefs. A trial court can also properly consider the standard of living established during the marriage. And in this case, the standard of living was very high. The evidence was uncontroverted that the husband had earned, before he decided to stop working, about $1.5 million a year in distributions. There is some appellate authority that talks about imputing income and determining whether a party is unemployed voluntarily or underemployed for maintenance purposes. I cited the case of In re Marriage of Fernstrom in the brief. And in that case, the court prefaced its finding. That was, by the way, an opinion by Judge Dubofsky when he sat on this Court of Appeals. And the opinion says that a court can consider, when it's dealing with future earning capacity and the standard of living established during the marriage, it may determine whether a parent is voluntarily underemployed for those purposes. There's also a case called In re the Marriage of Swing, which is cited in our brief. That's an early retirement case. And in that case, it was held that the court can consider reduced income as a result of early retirement, this is early voluntary retirement, to determine whether a spouse is, and in the words of the Swing Court, voluntarily unemployed or underemployed. In the Swing case, the court cited a case called In re the Marriage of Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S, which is at 916 Pacific 2nd, 615. Now, that Bowles case is not cited in our brief, Your Honor. However, in the Bowles case, the Court of Appeals held that a court can consider a payor's current spouse, a maintenance payor's current spouse's income as a circumstance in the determination of whether the payor spouse, who reduced his income as a result of the contributions from his new wife, to consider whether that spouse is, quote, voluntarily underemployed. As a last item, we now, as a result of an amendment to CRS 1410.114, our maintenance statute, we now have temporary maintenance guidelines, where the combined income of the parties is $75,000 a year or less. Well, in that statute, 1410.114, subsection 2B, Roman numeral 4, capital A, that statute says, for purposes of temporary maintenance guidelines, income means the same as described in 1410.115, subsection 3, which talks about imputed income. And I believe my time is up. Thank you.
Now you have just a little bit less than a minute.
I'll be brief. We go directly to the question from the court about the testimony concerning value. the loss, the real estate, had stipulated values. The other asset of JCI was a certificate of deposit, also a stipulated value. The real estate lots had a value of $6 to $7 million. So what? The debt against the asset was over $10 million. So the net value of the asset was a negative number. Mr. Walker struggles with the issue of gift, and I don't blame him. There is no evidence, there was no evidence before the court regarding a separate property claim. In fact, quoting very briefly from the wife's own trial management certificate, she says that it is the wife's position that the luxury suite, that's the condominium at Bachelor Gulch, be deemed to be 100% marital property, and that the proceeds from it be awarded to her. That's why there was no evidence, there was no claim, there was no testimony regarding this any separate property interest. It wasn't contested that it was gifted, but it was gifted to the marriage. The burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that it's separate is not on the donor, it's on the donee. And she failed to meet that burden. Our request is that the court remand the case with instructions that the Bachelor Gulch property is marital, that the court is to adopt the stipulation of the parties as to value, and that the court, taking into account the parties' current circumstances, is to create an equitable division of the assets, and once done, then determine whether or not maintenance should be awarded. Thank you.
Ma'am, I thank both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. Continue to issue in due course.